Chapter 22. 1. Seattle, Washington, the Austins Lake Union home, 2 days before Thanksgiving, 2038. Charlie sat in seat 12C of the half-full Yukon Air Flight 1564 as it soared north above the forested mountains and green valleys of western Oregon to its destination in Seattle, Washington. This year, his mother had declared that the family would be celebrating Thanksgiving at their Seattle home on Lake Union. While sipping a soda, Charlie recalled the story his mother liked to share about a flight she had taken on a private jet from Eugene to Seattle to interview with the Seattle Art Museum. She was fond of talking about how she bartered with the plane's owner to exchange one of her paintings for a seat on the plane. That was about 14 years before Charlie was born, but it was classic Cheryl. His mother had no fear when it came to negotiating. He missed his parents. He hadn't seen them since they delivered him to campus in September. He should have been more excited about the visit, but he feared their response when he revealed his plans to change the focus of his studies from marketing to political science. He vowed to stand his ground. He had a right to choose. Besides, he would make the point that marketing was nothing more than clever manipulation by capitalists. An hour later, he was standing curbside at SeaTac Airport when his father's silver BMW pulled up right on time. The passenger door swung open. His mother jumped out of the sedan and greeted him with a strong hug.
"Hello, dear. Goodness, have you lost weight?"
Cheryl said. "Hi, Mom. Good to see you." He stepped to the rear of the car where his father stood waiting with the trunk open. His father shook his hand strongly, then drew him close for a hug. "Hi, son. Toss your bag in the trunk. Hey, don't they have hair salons in Eugene anymore?" Clay playfully knocked a few strands of hair from Charlie's shoulder with his fingers. Charlie settled into the back seat feeling loved and comfortable. Maybe a little too comfortable. After all, he was sitting on soft leather seats of a luxury high-performance sedan that cost his dad in the neighborhood of $175,000 2 years ago. He recalculated. That would be about 88,000 UN marks today. The guilt he felt wasn't so much from the luxury he was enjoying at the moment. It was from knowing where the money had come from to buy the car. Clay, his dad, had been a partner in a very successful marketing agency, which he had sold back in 2017, earning him in the neighborhood of $10 million. His dad had made a fortune by being a capitalist, a darn good one, too. So here Charlie sat in an expensive car traveling to an exclusive and expensive houseboat home on Lake Union, a second home at that, all of which capitalism paid for. For that matter, the money his mom and dad had earned in a capitalist system was paying for his education. Did all this make him a hypocrite by organizing for socialist change? He realized that life had been pretty simple until he went to college. Then it all got complicated. 2. His dad steered the BMW slowly through the security gate and into its assigned parking space. There were only 12 parking spaces here, one for each of the floating homes attached to two docks extending from the southeastern shore into Lake Union, a small, picturesque lake on the north end of downtown Seattle. The Austin's houseboat was at the end of the dock with an unobstructed view of the lake, the downtown skyline to the south. Punctuating the western horizon was the historic Space Needle and Queen Anne Hill. His father had owned the home before marrying his mother. After settling in Reef Bay, they decided to keep the home to have a place to stay on their frequent trips to the city. Charlie loved this place and was especially fond of paddling the kayak around the lake for quiet hours by himself. Whenever he did, though, he could count on his dad insisting on helping him get into the unsteady kayak from the dock. Charlie knew how to do the maneuver but let his dad help. There was a reason for his dad's anxiety. The man had almost died in a kayak accident right next to the house. Actually, according to the story his dad wrote later, he was clinically dead until Jesus paid him a visit. That story and others about how his parents came to Christ were hugely influential on his journey of faith, a faith he was beginning to question. While helping to unpack the car, He wondered whether sometime this weekend he should show his parents the Christian socialist pamphlet in his bag. After settling in, the three relaxed in the living room in front of a blazing fire while enjoying mugs of tea. It was a typical gloomy November day, but inside was warm and cheerful.
"Here's the game plan for the weekend," his mother announced. "Tomorrow is Wednesday. I have a few things to buy at the grocery store. Both of you can help me in the kitchen after. We're invited to dinner with the Johansons at their home in Issaquah."
"Who's that?" Charlie asked.
"You remember Rosamie and Brian, don't you?"
Cheryl said.
"Oh, yeah."
Charlie remembered the couple, longtime friends of his parents, but what he remembered most was their gorgeous daughter.
"Will Mia be there?"
"Gee, I don't know, dear. She's been away at school. Why do you ask?"
His mother had that look in her eye that told Charlie she was playing with him. She knew exactly why he had asked. In fact, on more than one occasion, she had teased Charlie that he and Mia would make a fine couple. His mother and Rosamie were probably playing matchmaker behind his back. It wouldn't surprise him if the purpose of the dinner was to kindle a flame.
"Just wondered if I'll have anyone to talk to," Charlie said.
"We're having Thanksgiving dinner at our house, just the three of us. Then I thought we'd take a drive downtown," Clay said.
"What's downtown?" Charlie said. "That's where the football stadium is."
"So?" "We have three tickets to watch the Seahawks play the 49ers.
"No way! That's fantastic! I didn't know the Seahawks were playing on Thanksgiving this year. That's awesome, Dad."
"Friday we can kick back and watch a movie, maybe do some kayaking if the weather is good," Clay said.
"It all sounds great. It's good to be home," Charlie said.
Clay's phone buzzed. He retrieved it from a pocket, glanced at the display, and immediately tapped to answer.
"Hi, Glenn, what's up?"
Charlie figured that Glenn was Glenn Bartlett, the family's attorney in Reef Bay. The man had to be in his early 70s, but had a sharp mind and determination of steel. His father's face turned serious, and he walked into the kitchen with the phone to his ear.
"I see, I see. How long?" "Dear God, you're sure it's okay to visit?"
"Okay.
Thank you, Glenn."
Charlie and his mother watched Clay return from the kitchen.
"I have some bad news. It's Avery. She's not going to make it. The doctors are giving her less than 24 hours to live."
"That can't be right. She just had an infection," Charlie said.
"Infections can kill, son. Especially if the body is already weak, like Avery's," Clay said.
The term gut punch wasn't adequate for what Charlie was experiencing. He felt like his entire body had been slammed to the earth by an invisible force, only to have that force jump up and down on his chest, punishing his heart. Sorrow and guilt washed over him like hot acid, eating away what little composure remained.
"No!"
Charlie raced to his room and slammed the door. 3. Clay took a seat next to Cheryl and held her close.
"What else did Glenn say?" Cheryl asked.
"Just that Avery's folks agreed that Charlie could visit, but they couldn't guarantee that Avery will be conscious when he's there, or how she'll react if she does recognize him."
"If he's going to visit, he'd better do it now before it's too late,"
Cheryl said, tears welling up in her eyes. She could feel the pain her son was experiencing.
"I'll tell him," Clay said.
Clay walked through the kitchen down the short hall to the guest bedroom that Charlie used when the family was there. He knocked gently on the door.
"Son, please come out. We have something urgent to discuss about Avery," Clay said.
After a short pause, the door opened. Charlie left the bedroom and rejoined his parents in the living room.
"Avery's parents gave you permission to see her in the hospital," Clay said.
"When?"
"If you decide to see her, and you're under no pressure to do so, you need to leave now."
"Can I have the keys to the car?"
"Of course, but I prefer you take a rideshare. You won't be able to focus on driving," Clay said.
"And dear, think this through. You haven't seen Avery since the night of the crash. She won't look like you remember. The poor girl has gone through so much these past 5 months."
"I don't care. I want to see her."
"It's your decision, but listen to your mother carefully.
People near death, those who've suffered for months, aren't going to look like how we remembered them.
I don't care. I want to see her. I want her to see me, to know I care.
Charlie broke down. Tears flowed freely down his face. At last, he took a deep breath.
I'll take a rideshare. Where is the hospital?
4. Charlie stood unnoticed outside the glass wall, looking into Avery's dimly lit room at the ICU of Harborview Medical Center. Seated in the room, heads bowed, were Avery's parents and another person who appeared to be reading from a Bible. On the bed, a body scarcely large enough to make a lump under the covers lay still. The head was turned away. All he could see was short, matted hair with pinkish bald spots where he assumed the hair hadn't been able to grow back. Drawing up all his courage, he gently tapped on the window. The heads of Avery's parents and the stranger slowly looked his way. Her parents just gazed at him through dark, sunken eyes, no expression on their face except exhaustion. After an intolerable pause, Avery's mother gently touched her daughter's shoulder, leaned close, and whispered into her ear. Her father increased the light in the room so Charlie could see better. The small head slowly, so slowly, began to turn in his direction. It seemed to Charlie that she was marshaling all of her strength just to complete the simple motion. His tears were flowing freely now. Breath came in sobs and gasps. One second he wanted to run away down the hall as fast as he could. The next moment he wanted to burst into the room and wrap his arms around her. But his feet were frozen in place. All he could do was look back. He didn't recognize her. For a shocking minute he thought he had the wrong room. This couldn't be Avery. Whoever it was in that bed looked nothing like the vivacious red-headed cheerleader who had lit up the world in high school, the sweet, sexy girl who gave him his first kiss. He wiped tears from his eyes so he could see any response from her. Would she smile? Would she cry? Would she turn away in anger? Would she have a look of forgiveness? Oh God, that's what he wanted. A look, a simple gesture that would tell him it was okay. She understood. She forgave him. But all he saw was this skeleton of a girl looking at him with half-dead eyes. He forced a smile, then a tender, weak wave of a hand. It was a totally inadequate response, but what else could he do? He felt weak and placed both hands on the glass for support, all the while not taking his eyes off her. Through watery eyes, he noticed the slightest of movement in her right hand. Two fingers slowly rose from the bed cover as if that was all the strength she could muster to wave back. There was the slightest movement on her lips and a short flash of light in her eyes. Then nothing. He saw her parents stand up and point frantically at the monitor screen. A nurse raced by him and entered the room. Then another nurse rushed into the room. The curtain was drawn closed inside the glass wall, blocking his view. Nothing more to see. Avery was gone. He turned toward the elevator. He noticed a male nurse look up at him as he passed the nurse's station.
"You could have done more to save her, you greedy piece of crap!"
Charlie shouted at the top of his lungs.